Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode, I'll take you through it, point by point, as we continue our search to discover what happened to Damien Hurd and who, if anyone, is responsible. From Cold Case Productions, this is Final Days on Earth, the life and death of Damien Hurd. Episode 10, The Report. I'm your host, Claire Sanima. Thanks for listening. 2 days after police closed the case, the Gunnison Country Times asked over 1,000 readers in a survey, do you believe Gunnison police were justified in closing an investigation into the death of student-athlete Damien Hurd? 85% of respondents did not believe the case should have been closed. At the request of the Gunnison Police Department, in June 2014, Denver Police Lieutenant Matthew Murray conducted an independent review of the investigation into Damien's death while it was still in progress. In his report, Murray wrote that Damien's father claimed Gunnison police did not handle the investigation properly and that his son was murdered.
It seems clear to me that the impetus for his review was your disbelief that Damien had killed himself.
And also, he was not happy with the fact that I had been on the news and on social media chastising the Gunnison Police Department and how they were handling the investigation.
In the spring of 2020, I contacted Matthew Murray, now Chief of Police in Yakima, Washington, to request an interview for this podcast. To my surprise and delight, he was up for the challenge. But first, he had a few questions of his own.
Pardon me for asking questions, but I was the PIO for the Denver Police Department for 10 years.
Yeah, no, I love questions. I'm a journalist, so questions I have no problem with.
So what drove you to do this story?
I've been a crime reporter since 2014. It was just one of those early cases, I guess, that kind of got in my head.
So, pardon me, but I have to ask, do you have an outcome in mind? Do you have an axe to grind? Do you believe that it's wrong? I mean, are you heading in a direction that I need to know about?
I don't know Damien. I never knew him. There's nothing personal about this, other than I just find it a really fascinating story. I do think there are a lot of questions that weren't answered in that police report. I think that there have to be some answers that we can still get to this case. My whole thing is follow the story. That's really the guiding principle of, you know, my journalistic life. So I'm just following the story wherever it takes me.
I don't mind answering tough questions. I don't want to get sandbagged into this whole, if you're already got your mind made up, then there's not much point in me talking to you.
Yeah, no, my mind is not made up. My mind is not made up in either direction. I will be completely honest with you. I go back and forth on a daily basis of what I think happened to Damien Hurd. I think there's so many compelling pieces of information on all sides of it. So I'm all ears if you wanna talk and
let's go. You can ask me anything.
Chief Murray is a 30-year police veteran and a certified court expert in homicide cases. At the request of Gunnison Police Captain Chris Wilson, in the summer of 2014, Murray wrote two forensic analysis reports on the Damien Hurd death investigation.
The case wasn't closed until October. So this was like a health check of the investigation in progress. Is that a good way
yeah.
to describe it?
They knew that it was controversial and that there was some real resistance on the family part. Specifically, my recollection is the dad.
Yeah.
And they were concerned that if they didn't just triple check it before they came out with a conclusion, they'd be sorry.
Murray's first report was dated June 4th and was developed using an isolated review of evidence photos.
So they gave me the pictures with nothing else. So that's a blind analysis, 100%, with no other information. I knew that they were investigating a death. I knew it was controversial, and I knew nothing else. I knew none of the facts. Didn't even know his name.
Murray noted that he intentionally did not read the accompanying police report before reaching his initial opinion. This way, his observations would not be clouded by statements or conclusions from others.
All I was doing was looking at physical evidence, which doesn't change. A witness statement can change, but the evidence should not. If it does, somebody tampered with it.
At the outset of the report, Murray listed his professional opinion of Damien's case. The victim died as a result of suicide by hanging. To support his finding, Murray listed 17 points that he observed from the evidence photos. Let's start at the beginning. Here is Murray's first point.
The victim was found alone. This is the most common mode of discovery in suicide deaths. Rarely is another person present with death by suicide. I have never investigated or supervised a suicide by hanging where another person was present.
What stood out about this first point to me is that everyone admits Damien's body had been at the Cabin Creek location for at least 3 days before police discovered it. Yes, Damien was alone on April 2, 2014, but a key witness placed Damien's body at the scene on Sunday, March 30th.
I definitely don't disagree with the fact that he was discovered alone. I'm with you, right? But
What
did you think of Linda Nienhauser's report that she saw Damien's body hanging on Sunday afternoon, and she also saw another vehicle and two bicycles on the path that led up to Damien's body, and that she thought she saw someone crouching using binoculars and looking back at her?
So the first thing you think you have to do is go to what I said to you at the beginning. Does any evidence suggest that that's true? Because evidence can't change and people's statements can't. I take what she tells me and I compare it to the physical evidence and say, is what she's saying, can it fit with the physical evidence as I see it? And it can't.
So the idea that she saw another car, that she saw these two bicycles, you don't believe that she saw those things, or you don't think it's relevant?
Oh, I hear what you're saying. What I'm saying is that she said there was a body kneeling by him. That's not possible. We know it's not. We have the pictures. So now you have this major discrepancy in what it is she's saying. I have to question some of the other parts of what it is she's saying. And then I would also say this. Let's say she did see the body hanging before. Does that make it a homicide?
I don't know. I mean, the thing for me that was most compelling about it, not that she saw the body and boom, it's a homicide, but the idea that she saw evidence of other people around Damien's body, and those people didn't call and say, hey, there's a dead body on the hill, you know, that was weird to me.
Were there people who saw Damien hung and didn't report it? That's possible. But what I can tell you is, even if that happened, it doesn't change the fact that at the scene, there's no evidence of a second, third, fourth, fifth, or whatever party. There's evidence of one party. So it doesn't change whether it's suicide or not, even if that's true. So I don't really need to focus on whether what she's saying is true or not, because it's not a crime not to report a suicide. What I need to do is say, is this a homicide or is this a suicide? And I have to always come back to the physical evidence that doesn't change. There's no evidence whatsoever at the scene that a second party was present.
There are reports that at the time that Damien went missing and in the days that he was missing, that there was a light frost on the ground. Linda talks about there being snow. There were bicycle tracks in the snow. So the idea that there's no evidence of another person at the scene, I mean, if there had been snow on the ground and it had melted, what kind of evidence would there be of another person at the scene?
That's a great question, but is there evidence of anyone at the scene? Let me ask you that. Have you seen the pictures?
I have seen the pictures, yes.
Why would the killer's stuff disappear in the snow and the frost and not Damien? See, two people would have left the same evidence.
Well, I didn't see any footprints. I didn't see, like, one set of footprints.
Yeah, there was a little bit of footprints. There was also a trail. There was the cable that was left. Now, that could have been left by a killer as well. If you and I decide to kill a third person, which even with two of us, that would be really, really hard. Imagine what would be left in that soft dirt if you and I were trying to lift a body.
The Cabin Creek location where Damien was found is an established hiking area. There's no disputing that other people visited the area in the days between Damien's disappearance on March 30th and the discovery of his body on April 2nd. What is in dispute is whether or not these people had anything to do with his death. Murray's second point is that Damien's car was the only vehicle at the scene.
If this were a homicide, then there would have to be a second vehicle, or the murderer killed the victim and then left his vehicle to walk back to town. If there was a second vehicle, then the killer and the victim would have had to travel to a remote location via separate cars, or numerous parties were involved in the plot, and then the killer left the victim and his vehicle. This would indicate that the victim knew his killer and traveled to a remote location with him or her.
All of Murray's points about the necessity of another vehicle needed for a homicide are satisfied by Linda's eyewitness account, which predates the evidence photos by 3 days.
Not only does Linda say that she sees another car on Sunday, but there's a tip call from a guy named Matt Marvel, who also says that he saw other cars parked out at Cabin Creek. And interestingly enough, his description of the cars does not include an SUV that matches Damien's car. So, in my mind, it raised the question, was someone moving Damien's car after he was dead?
So, one of the things that I learned early on in death investigation, that the simplest answer is where you start, right? Occam's razor.
Absolutely.
Like, I can come up with lots of crazy theories about how something might happen. But the most likely theory is not that Damien hung himself and then somebody came and moved his car. So I'm going to keep coming back to the same thing. There's no evidence of a second party at the scene. So then I have to say this. Whether his car was moved or not is irrelevant to the murder or suicide. It may be relevant to other things. You know, it may be possible, Claire, that somebody said, you should kill yourself. We don't know. And then that person may have tried to hide that. I don't know. What I do know, though, is that regardless of what the witness says about cars, or moving cars, or when the body was there, there's just no evidence. I have to come back to that every time. Because how does this killing occur, even if there's some strange witness testimony, and not have any evidence left to indicate that it was homicidal?
You're talking about there not being more disruption in the landscape, in the dirt.
The branch that he picked, the method, what he used to hang himself with, the fact that there was evidence that nobody else came in the car with him. When the police show up and we have pictures, we know there was only one car. Could there have been another car? Sure. But if there was another car and they killed Damien, they did it without leaving a trace of evidence and he did not resist.
Murray's third point is that Damien's keys were in his back pocket.
It is highly unlikely that a killer would kill the victim and then place his keys into the victim's back pocket.
This is an interesting one for several reasons. First, we know that Damien's student ID card was on his key ring, and that Western State officials believed that his ID was used on campus 3 separate times after his death. And second, we have eyewitness statements indicating Damien's car was moved on Monday, the same day his ID card was used on campus. Is it just a coincidence that the keys and the card are attached, and there are reports of both being used in the same time frame? By Wednesday, there's no disputing Damien's ID and his keys are in his back pocket. But that doesn't necessarily mean they never left it.
So something that we talked about, the simplest explanation is the right one. I actually have that in one of my lines of narration whenever I talk about this case. To me, the simplest explanation of that is, well, there are not 3 separate technical glitches that day that just happened to coincide with Damien Hurd, right? The simplest explanation is that somebody used his card.
And they probably did it all the time. It was probably normal for that group. Did you not have a group of friends that you would be like, hey, check me into class?
No, I absolutely did. I'm with you there. Here, this is the weird part about it. His student ID is found in his back pocket.
We know from other witness reports that Damien had to manually enter his student number to use his ID card. Even Murray believes the idea that Damien's friends already had his student ID number memorized when he went missing is a stretch.
It definitely seems like there's something fishy about that whole situation.
Well, I gotta agree with you. It doesn't change anything about murder-suicide, but something ain't right there. Something doesn't add up.
That's one of the questions I really want to answer with the podcast. I feel like that's something that would help, because I know that was a really big deal to the dad.
If you are the dad, and you were told your son was in class, how do you let that go with some simple little brush-off answer?
Yeah, and not just in one class, but he's in class, he's in the cafeteria, he's in class again. I mean, this is an active day.
That's an official statement that your son was alive after they tell you he's dead. Of course you would be suspicious about that.
Murray's fourth point is about the position of items in Damien's vehicle when discovered by police.
The victim's vehicle has items on all of the visible seats except for the driver's seat. This is indicative of the victim traveling to the location alone and being alone after arriving.
We have no way of knowing what the state of Damien's car was when he arrived at the scene at Cabin Creek. The best information we have, however, is that Damien drove a carload of wrestlers around on Saturday afternoon to the Crab Feed fundraiser. Presumably at that time, the passenger seats in Damien's car would have been cleared of any items.
So why does somebody else put items all over the seats in a car?
Because they're looking for something to hang a body, an unconscious body.
So they drove a dead body out there without a rope.
The fact that you would commit suicide with jumper cables, that you wouldn't go get a rope, to me that's crazy.
We know the car was in a state of disarray and appeared to have been ransacked. Case in point, the ripped open package and missing LeBron James t-shirt.
We can look for anything that is possible, or we can go to what's most likely. Often with a conspiracy, people look for very obscure pieces of evidence that are unanswerable, and then they use those in a pile to begin to build what looks like an enormous case, when in actuality, we've got a lot of unanswered things. Is it possible that somebody stole the LeBron James jersey after the suicide? Of course, I can't refute that. There's evidence that it was packaged, there's now evidence that it's not packaged, and there's no jersey. My question, though, in return would be, why didn't anything else get stolen? There's things of a lot more value in that car than that jersey. Did it just happen to be somebody who got lucky that loves LeBron? There's no evidence that even if somebody stole that jersey, they participated in a homicide. The suicide, even with these unanswered questions, stands alone.
Talking about Damien and other things that may or may not be missing, the night that he disappeared, you know, he was photographed wearing these flashy diamond stud earrings. They weren't...
Yeah, I remember.
You remember those, right? So they weren't actually real. They were cubic zirconia. They were $25. He'd bought them recently. The receipt was one of the items recovered from his car. As far as I can tell, and please let me know if you know otherwise, those earrings have never been found. They were not on Damien's body when he was located. That is a question in my mind. What happened to the earrings?
Yeah, I know nothing about that, and it's a good question. Is it also throwing out a theory, just like you can do it the other way? Another thing that's not unusual when people are contemplating suicide, in fact, it's relatively common if they give things away.
If Damien gave his earrings away to anyone in the hours after he went missing from the wrestler's house party, that would be news to me. There's certainly no evidence to indicate that's true, and no one has come forward claiming to have the earrings. In fact, just like Damien's blue coat and his baseball cap, police have never been able to account for them. Murray's fifth point concerns the location of Damien's car.
The victim appears to have been parked at the location where the vehicle was found for an extended time. This is common in suicide deaths, as the victim often contemplates his decision to die.
We know precious little about the timing of Damien's actual death, only that he left the City Market gas station at 1:36 a.m. on March 30th, 2014, and that Linda Nienhauser saw a figure on the ridge matching Damien's description about 10 to 12 hours later while she was hiking. Police officially identified Damien's body at Cabin Creek on April 2nd. At that time, Detective Danos noted the smell of weed in the car and that Damien's windshield wipers were in the intermittent position. It had been raining and sleeting Saturday night and into Sunday morning. Conditions were clear on April 2nd when police arrived on scene. We know from the scene photos that the driver's seat in Damien's car was in a reclined position. Murray believes that Damien is the one who put it there.
That whole contemplating, thinking about things, so probably just in a relaxed position, spend a lot of time thinking, but all that's very much supposition.
There's no credible evidence indicating how long Damien's car was parked at Cabin Creek before his death that I'm aware of. Police noted there was a half tank of gas on the gauge and the hood was cold to the touch when they arrived. As we discussed in previous episodes, Damien's seat being reclined would fit with the theory that someone else was driving his car.
It has been posited that one possible explanation for the driver's seat being in a reclined position would have been for a taller person to drive the vehicle. How does that sit with you?
Certainly, it is possible. What does that change? Even if somebody tall drove his car, it still doesn't change the suicide.
I agree that by itself, someone else driving Damien's car doesn't overturn the suicide ruling. But if you can start to poke holes in the evidence proving that Damien was alone at Cabin Creek, it does weaken the case for suicide. After all, Murray's very first point included the statement that he had never encountered a suicide by hanging where another person was present.
If somebody else drove the car, where was he? Because
the idea that he would be, that he would be incapacitated.
Murray's sixth and seventh points address the manner and means of Damien's death.
There is no evidence of a struggle. The victim's shoes are not scuffed, and the area leading to and around the body shows no evidence of a struggle. The death was somewhat spontaneous. This is evidenced by use of jumper cables as a ligature rather than bringing an item, like a rope, for the purpose of hanging.
Whether suicide or homicide, there's no disputing that Damien's death was spur of the moment. But the lack of evidence of a struggle, in my mind, doesn't necessarily point to the injuries being self-inflicted. If someone else was involved in Damien's death, I believe the strongest theory is that he was brought unconscious to Cabin Creek. In this scenario, there wouldn't have been signs of a struggle on Damien's body. It's true that Damien's shoes were not scuffed, but they were untied, and his pants were unzipped. This state of undress is bizarre considering both the hike needed to reach the rock point where Damien died and the freezing temperatures.
And I also did notice that, to me at least, his shoes looked extremely clean. Like, you talked about how they weren't scuffed, but, you know, they also didn't, like, appear to have dirt on them. They didn't look like shoes that had been on a hike. I guess I just...
I totally agree with you, but I would be less expecting the shoes to be scuffed than the ground. The ground is what moves me, you know, the lack of disturbance of the ground, not the shoes. Especially like you said, what if the ground's frozen? I mean, how much is really going to get on his shoes?
Right, but if the ground is frozen, then how much is really going to get disturbed under the soft dirt?
In the woods, probably a lot, because I doubt it's frozen like a playground would be. And I didn't go check, so
yeah.
That's a good question.
Murray's eighth point deals with the complexity of the crime scene.
Homicide by hanging is very difficult to accomplish. The killer would have to render the victim unconscious, then both lift the victim and tie the ligature around his neck. This is after having already tied the ligature around a branch. Unless heavily sedated, the victim would have had to have been witness to part of this process and then not struggled or resisted the homicide. Also, homicide by hanging, as often seen in Old West hangings, most commonly uses a pre-tied noose to make the act easier to accomplish. In my opinion, it would be impossible, even with several killers, to lift the victim, tie the cables around his neck, and then hang him with no evidence of other parties on the ground around the victim.
It's true that Damien's death scene is a conundrum, no matter how you look at it. But if Damien was the victim of a homicide, the most likely scenario is that multiple assailants were involved. These would have been people who knew Damien, and it stands to reason they would have been physically capable of picking up the 125-pound freshman and placing him in a noose. Chief Murray says that's a tall order.
We know his car was at the scene. We don't know who drove it. We know his cell phone was at the scene. We don't know who took it out, but we have no indication that it was anybody other than him. Somehow, regardless of how high he was, he got hung on a tree, and there's no indication that anybody else did that. And it's a hard, hard, hard thing to do. I'll tell you what, this would be a totally, and you can say this, totally different conversation if he died of an overdose. Totally different conversation if he died of slitting his wrist. The hanging makes it so difficult for any other theory to be true. The mode of suicide really, really, really is hard to replicate.
From this description, you might think Damien was hanging, suspended, from the tree. But as we covered in episode 4, Damien's toes were actually touching the ground, and his body was partially leaned up against a rock. His official cause of death was asphyxiation, which is defined as a lack of oxygen. Chief Murray's argument here acts like the whole hanging scene had to be thoroughly planned out to stage a suicide. But to me, it didn't look like a typical hanging at all. It's a haphazard scene, which could be explained by desperation, panic, and inexperience. In the scene photos, it looks like Damien was quasi-strung up with whatever items someone happened to find in his car, hence the sleeping bag and the jumper cables. Murray's 9th and 10th points concern the conditions of the jumper cables.
The cable around the victim's neck was tied in a double knot. A killer would not have taken time to do this. Besides, the killer would be holding all of the victim's weight as he tied the knot. It would be extremely difficult to do this, and there would be no purpose in tying it double. The fact that cables were pulled apart is another indication of suicide. The killer would have no need to do this. It was likely done to make them more pliable.
There's inherent difficulty for anyone, Damien included, in manipulating the jumper cables in freezing cold temperatures in the middle of the night. Damien wasn't even wearing gloves, and there was no flashlight or light source found at the scene. The last time that Damien is accounted for is at 1:36 a.m., whenever he leaves the City Market gas station. According to weather records, the sun rose at 6:58 a.m. on March 30th in Gunnison, Colorado.
Well, I think it likely happened in the middle of the night. I bet you after he took that battery out, he went and did it. One thing about suicide, people don't spend hours and hours and hours contemplating this.
How Damien would have been able to accomplish this complicated jumper cable noose hanging in the middle of the night without even the flashlight on his phone has always been a question in my mind.
I'm a Colorado native. I know Colorado. I know the Gunnison area. I'm very familiar with it. It's not like some places in the country like where I'm at now. If you go in the woods here in the night, it's extremely dark. Colorado is really not like that. Even on a night with no moon, you can generally see around. You said there was snow. That would make it even brighter. I mean, the fact that there's no man-made light source does not mean there's not light. There's probably a lot of light.
That makes more sense to me. I was trying to get to the point of waiting for daylight, and I'm like, I don't see how you sit for 5 hours and still want to kill yourself. We talked about it being very cold, and you've got this ambient light. You're manipulating these jumper cables in this less than ideal circumstances. No gloves found at the scene. Can you just kind of talk me through whether you see that as an impairment?
So the very most likely scenario is he grabs the jumper cables, pulls them apart on the way to the car, drops one, and does the deal. How much, I mean, do you need gloves? Most suicide as a result of depression, it's a desire to be free of the pain. He's not going to care that much about cold or whether my fingers get cut.
Somewhat at odds with that statement, Murray's next points address Damien's sweatshirt and his sleeping bag.
The victim's hoodie was pulled over his head. This is not the action a killer would take. Killers are not concerned with the comfort of their victims. The only exception I have seen in this is mercy killings, usually by an elderly spouse when unable to care for their ailing partner. A killer would not place a sleeping bag under a victim. I believe the victim either used this for comfort, it was cold, or to slide down the rock more easier to accomplish hanging. A killer would not have unzipped the sleeping bag. This is similar to the keys in the pocket. Although it's possible for a killer to do this, I have never seen a murderer so organized and adept at concealing homicide to think of these last-minute details to stage a suicide.
Let's start with the sweatshirt. Murray says pulling the hoodie over a victim's head is not an action a killer would take. He goes on to describe an exception for mercy killings. However, it's not hard to imagine a reason why someone who knew Damien would want to cover his face. It's not like anyone is suggesting that Damien was killed by a stranger in a random act of violence.
What about the idea that if the person who was killing Damien knew him and felt some guilt or some shame about it, wouldn't that be a possible reason to do something to cover his face?
In the aftermath, yes, but you would likely cover him with the blanket, not the hood. And what was the ligature around the outside of the hood, or was it underneath?
It was on the outside.
So that answers the question. A killer doesn't give a crap. There's no reason to put a hood over you and then do it. If they were trying to hide your face because we didn't want to see it anymore, they would cover you with a whole blanket. They don't see any of your body. And I have seen that several times, by the way. That is absolutely true. But that's typically when you're humiliated or embarrassed or ashamed. And you don't want to see any part of it. It's like this weird psychological thing, like it washes it from my mind. And when we see that, by the way, we immediately start looking at people very close to them.
Yeah, that's something, it reminded me of another case where a husband had strangled his wife, and then as she was lying in their bed, he put a Target plastic bag over her head. He ended up confessing and saying, yeah, I put the bag over her head because I didn't want to look at her.
For reference, this is the 2017 murder of Crystal McDowell by her husband, Steve McDowell, in Baytown, Texas. As we continued to discuss the case, Murray did find some incongruity between Damien not wearing gloves, but pulling the hood over his head.
Can I tell you something on your end?
Sure.
It does fly in the face of the hood, though. Why put the hood on if you're not caring about comfort? Because that, to me, is, it's almost like a normal, that's a normal thing he would probably do, put his hood on when it's cold. So maybe it's that, but maybe it's comfort. And certainly, if comfort was the issue, why not wear the gloves? So those two things are sort of at odds.
The sleeping bag is a point of great interest to me. Taken in context with the condition of Damien's other clothing, his untied shoes and his unzipped pants, I've often wondered if Damien's unconscious body was carried inside the sleeping bag, up to the rock point. Because of my background as a crime reporter, I know how difficult it is for perpetrators to move a dead body. I'm aware of killers who used golf bags, Rubbermaid storage bins, and even suitcases to carry a dead body to a second location after a murder. In Damien's case, it would be consistent with eyewitness testimony of Linda Nienhauser that multiple people were present with Damien's body, and the fact that the sleeping bag was found unzipped.
Whenever I saw that sleeping bag, it popped into my head that if I were moving a dead body and I had a sleeping bag and I had more than one person, I might stick this dead body in a sleeping bag, zip it up, and then carry the body that way.
So you had me until zip up. Why would you zip it up?
So they wouldn't fall out.
Nah, come on, you looked at crime scene pictures. Crooks don't do that. They're in a hurry to get it over there, and what? So, I mean, the thing is, I hear you, I do, I'm not trying to attack.
I'm totally thick-skinned, I'm not worried.
Well, I'm telling you, in the homicide room, we do this to each other. Exactly what we do. Trying to poke holes in theories so that you can get on the right track.
In my mind, the sleeping bag plays into the rear naked choke theory that Gary Hurd favors. For this theory to work, you have to believe that Damien went back to the wrestler's house after getting gas and was then placed in a sleeper hold sometime after 1:36 a.m. It should be noted that there are no reports of any confrontation involving Damien occurring after he got gas. The report that most closely aligns with the sleeper hold theory is Morgan Lambert's statement about Kyle Pyatt placing Damien in a chokehold at the party around midnight. Interestingly enough, Chief Murray was not aware of Morgan Lambert's witness statement at all. Her interview took place July 9, 2014, 1 month after Murray completed his expert report. Ever the investigator, Murray was all ears as I described the interview.
She gets up, it's a video interview, she acts out the hold. The hold that she's doing as she acts it out most closely resembles a rear naked choke.
Yeah, that is, yep.
Right, so a very well-known wrestling move that's also called the sleeper hold, right?
Yep.
So there are also multiple witnesses who say that the wrestlers, quote, put Damian to sleep after his fight, right? So if you follow this theory, if you go down this track, and we say that he was put to sleep in this rear naked choke, that he was rendered unconscious, then he was not tended to. They take his unconscious body out to Cabin Creek, and they carry him in the sleeping bag, and they stage the hanging scene with his jumper cables.
Okay. So you actually have a workable theory until you get to the tree. If they'd have tied the jumper cables around the car, I could tell you, you know what, Claire, I can't disprove that. The problem comes in transporting the dead body in the sleeping bag to the tree, lifting the body, hanging it from the tree, and leaving no evidence of that. That's the problem. The rest of that theory is actually, that's a pretty darn good theory.
The theory that Damian was unconscious from a rear naked choke when placed in the noose would explain why there were no signs of a struggle.
Physically, you actually came up with a decent theory there. You could do what you're describing, and it wouldn't show, because the ligature would cover any other trauma that might come from a sleeper hold, because it wouldn't leave marks. So that, physically, yes. That could I can't rule that out physically. I just would go with the rest of the circumstances surrounding. Because remember, you can't just dismiss this because one fact is convenient.
Murray's next 2 points concern the tree branch.
The branch chosen to accomplish the hanging was not sturdy. A suicidal party would use it, knowing it only had to hold his or her weight for a short time. A murderer would choose a much sturdier branch to ensure that death resulted. A killer would also choose a sturdier branch to hoist the victim. In other words, they would tie the ligature around the victim's neck and then use a sturdy branch as leverage to hoist the victim to a dangling position.
I agree Murray is describing ideal conditions for a hanging and what people with experience and foresight would do. But what if the small tree branch selection was simply a matter of necessity? Damien's father, Gary Hurd, visited Cabin Creek 9 days after his son's death.
Where Damien was hanging, where he was found, that is the only place within a decent amount of distance of that vicinity that there was a tree branch capable of being able to do this.
In his next point, Murray notes the large distance between the tree and Damien's car. The first responding officer with the Gunnison County Sheriff's Office estimated the distance at about 100 yards.
The distance between the tree where the victim was discovered and the victim's car is considerable. There is no evidence that the victim was forced to that location or evidence of another person leading to the tree.
We've already talked about how there was snow and ice in Gunnison when Damien went missing, and patches of melting snow are still visible in the police photos taken 4 days later. Even given the frozen ground theory, Murray thinks the scene is too complicated for college kids to have staged.
Somehow, you bring the body out to this remote location, drag it out there, you think about tying it up because we want to be able to hide what we did here. Let me tell you what kids actually do, because this happens, especially with overdose cases. They drive to an alley, they push the body out, and they hope to God nobody ever asks them a question.
Yeah.
They don't stage a hanging. There's so many better ways to try to hide a death.
The 17th and final point in Murray's first forensic analysis report is about the condition of Damien's cell phone.
The victim's cell phone had the battery removed. This was likely done to avoid taking phone calls that might change his decision, and possibly because he did not want to be found. There would be no purpose for a killer to remove the battery from the phone. Even all these years looking back, that cell phone is a big deal. Taking the batteries out of the cell phone is a big deal. That's not rational. You and I wouldn't do that because we're not depressed. When suicidal people do it, they're not removing that from you and me. They're removing it from themselves. They're trying to remove the option of survival because they hurt so bad.
Part of what makes this case so hard to fathom is the fact that Damien was never diagnosed with depression. And if he was battling suicidal thoughts, he didn't share that with the people closest to him. His ex-girlfriend Marlena only brought up suicide after Damien's body was discovered, which, considering the fact that he was found hanging, seems like an afterthought. When you start with a body in a noose, it's natural to wonder if depression is the cause. We also can't ignore the statement from Tori Boyle about Damien confiding in her that he was suicidal over Christmas break. But the weird misstating of facts that Damien was in Gunnison, not Texas, during Christmas makes me question the entire authenticity of her memory. For Chief Murray, the suicide theory fits perfectly with the evidence at the scene.
Now picture Damien in a car, and it's cold, and he's sad about his girlfriend, and he's been taking drugs and alcohol. He doesn't want his dad to call. He doesn't want his girlfriend to call. He doesn't want to make up with his friend. He wants to go. He's just trying to work up the courage to do it. So he takes the battery out. That's a very unusual action.
I definitely agree with you that it's a very unusual action, and I see how it could be the action of a suicidal person. But I have to say that one of the cases that I've done for 48 hours involves a killer who kills a girl and then disassembles her cell phone, takes the battery out of her phone because he doesn't want police to be able to... for her to be located, for people to track her location, you know, with cell phone towers.
Play it out. Why did he do that? Why doesn't he want her located?
Because he killed her.
And?
He doesn't want to get caught.
Right. You got to walk through this with me. He did it because he's afraid. He needs to give himself time to get away. So that's number one. Delay recovery of the body. And number two, that he knows he left evidence on that body that's going to link her to him.
He actually burned the body, so there was no physical evidence left that would have connected him.
In this case, which was the 2016 murder of Jackie Vandegrift by Charles Bryant in Grapevine, Texas, the killer took apart the victim's cell phone and kept her battery.
He broke it up. He threw it around. He got rid of it. You've got to think about the psychology of it, too. What is he doing? He's panicking. He's going to feel a measure of relief having that phone gone. Well, in this case, the killer, if there was a killer, they didn't destroy the phone. They left it right there with him. Then they left the battery. Why? If really what you're trying to do is similar, nothing else about it is similar, only that the battery's out.
As I've wrestled with this case for 6 years, I've gone back and forth on what I believe really happened at Cabin Creek. It's true that most hanging deaths are suicides, and I have to acknowledge that Damien's age, gender, and propensity for impulsive behavior are consistent with the finding of suicide. But in my opinion, there are still too many unanswered questions to reach a definite conclusion. Hiker Linda Nienhauser's eyewitness report of other people with Damien's body on Sunday. The use of Damien's student ID card in classes after his death on Monday. Sightings of Damien's Saturn SUV driving the route to Cabin Creek on Monday. The lack of connection between Damien and the Cabin Creek location where his body was found. And the unexplored theory that the track team was somehow involved. Suffice it to say, Chief Murray disagrees. His concluding statement, dated June 9, 2014, reads in full.
I have no reservation in opining that this death was caused by suicide. The victim drove to a remote location and contemplated his death. Once he'd decided, he looked for a ligature and walked to the nearest tree to hang himself. He pulled the cables apart, tied one end to the tree branch and then the other around his neck. He stood on his sleeping bag and then eased himself backwards until the cable cut the supply of blood from his brain. This was not a violent act, and therefore it did not take a sturdy branch or a great height. The suicide crime scene is consistent with the hundreds of suicide cases I have either personally investigated or supervised. I will conduct a subsequent review of all the reports, statements, and investigative notes to determine if they are consistent with the evidence I have reviewed.
Murray's second and final report was dated June 25th, 2014, 4 months before Gunnison police would officially close the case. After reviewing the case file as it existed in June, Murray listed what he believed pointed to Damien's death as a suicide.
There are three main themes which appear throughout the interviews and investigation. Damien Hurd's relationship with his former girlfriend, Marlena, Damien Hurd's fight over Marlena on March 29th, and the subsequent conflict with close friend Kyle Tyatt, and Damien Hurd's use of marijuana, alcohol, and possibly LSD.
Murray went on to call the Gunnison Police Department's work in Damien's case, quote, among the most thorough suicide investigations I have ever reviewed. Murray stated that investigators explored all leads to their conclusion, did not suffer tunnel vision, and were very thorough in their examination of witnesses.
I tell you, Claire, one of the things that I love about death investigation is the psychology. My favorite thing to do in the world is to go in an interview room with a suspect, because it's a battle of wits. Go in there and say, what am I thinking? Why am I standing here? Why would I do this? Because those answers, they give you an enormous power when you get in the interview room. Because I'm asking him questions that he has no idea why I would ask him that. And they really jump at you.
To illustrate his point, Murray brought up a classic cold case from Colorado that is the subject of intense speculation and conspiracy theories to this day. The murder of JonBenet Ramsey.
John Ramsey goes on CNN, and it's fascinating. Go back and look it up on Google. Watch the interview. They ask him to describe how he found his daughter. He says, I walk into the boiler room, and there's this window. It's his house. Why is he talking about a window, Claire? His dead daughter's on the floor.
Yeah.
Why is he talking about a window?
I don't know.
I do, because killers are looking to see who's watching. He was looking at the window when he put her in there.
Oh, wow. So you think the dad did it?
He did do it.
It's one of those cases that everybody has their theories. Yeah.
Although initially a suspect, John Ramsey maintains his innocence and has never been charged in his daughter's murder. The case is unsolved.
Go back and watch John's interview. The window. I'll tell you why, because he was looking at the window. A killer is thinking somebody's watching him.
Like using binoculars in the brush?
Think of something you've done wrong, and what's the first thing you do? How am I going to get caught? How if somebody knows?
Right, exactly. Like Linda Nienhauser said, she saw someone with binoculars looking at her from the scene.
I hear you. I'm just saying, like, that is what somebody who's guilty thinks. The first is self-protection. How am I going to get caught? And they're watching. And
yeah.
What do I need to do better?
I couldn't agree with the chief more about this analysis. And to me, it has a direct connection to the significance and credibility of Linda's memory.
Go back to Linda's statement in the fact that she said that someone was crouching down, looking back at her with binoculars. You know, she didn't know that that was a behavior that a killer would be more likely to exhibit. You know, she didn't even know she was looking at a dead body. And to me, that gave me pause.
I hear you, but just using your, like, you know, life experience and rational. So you kill somebody and then get binoculars out? Why would you do that?
I mean, people return to the scene of the crime, though. Isn't that part of the psychology of certain kinds of killers?
Yes, I had a guy who killed a baby, and I was at the crime scene when I looked up and saw him drive by. Yes, it does happen. I think in my case, the guy was just really curious, like, where's this going? Do they know? So, could they go back to the crime scene? Yes, but if it was the theory, I mean, I guess you have to pick a different theory then, because if it was the theory that the wrestling team accidentally killed him with a chokehold, there's no way they want to be anywhere near that body. They want to get it out of there. That's somewhat psychopathic.
Even though we disagreed on a number of things, namely the importance of Linda Nienhauser's eyewitness statement, it was refreshing to have an investigator so willing to talk about the nitty-gritty details of a controversial case like Damien's.
I work for the people. They have a right to know. The dad has a right to know. These questions, people have a right to ask them, and I am disappointed in the public entities that would hide behind not talking.
What Chief Murray said next is the most important statement I've heard in my 6 years of reporting on Damien's case.
If evidence surfaced, even today, that clearly showed that what I wrote in the report was not right, I would correct it. I'm not married to an outcome. But it would have to be compelling evidence that clearly demonstrated the likelihood would change.
Damien's father, Gary, is convinced that his son's case deserves more investigation and that Murray's report was not sufficient.
There was a whole bunch of stuff that Murray never had an opportunity to put his eye on. And that was in June. The case wasn't closed till October.
Chief Murray sympathizes with Gary Hurd's position.
Most homicide detectives will tell you some of their most challenging families are suicides, not homicides. People don't want to believe that their loved one would leave them. So you'll hear statements like in this case, I know my son. I know he wasn't suicidal. He would have told me. People who typically talk like that don't understand what clinical depression is. When somebody is clinically depressed, I mean literally clinically depressed, not just a lot depressed, they are so fixated on the pain, that trying to get rid of the pain, that everything else becomes secondary. Everything else.
There's no denying this is personal for Damien's dad, but Gary believes he has kept a level head.
And I still believe today that I looked at them not through rose-colored glasses. I didn't look through them with a narrative. I looked through them as a realist, and I took everything into account, and I'll say it again, I've said it to you a million times, still to this day, put something in front of me that indicates that D took his life, that I could get my head wrapped around and be like, maybe he did. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Maybe he did. Give it to me, and I'll think that way. The only thing that exists is things that point toward foul play and cover up.
On the next episode of Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Hurd, I still have plenty of questions of my own, so I'm hitting the road to Gunnison, Colorado to do some on-location reporting and fact-finding. It's a trip 6 years in the making, and I'm bringing you along for the ride.
Starting route to Gunnison Police Department.
So what I'm going to try to do is follow the path that Damien would have taken. Alright, we're here.
Final Days on Earth is recorded in Dallas, Texas for Cold Case Productions in partnership with Podcast One and Live by Live. Each episode is written, reported, and produced by me, Claire Sanimal. Original theme music composed and performed by Riley Simmons. Songs licensed from premiumbeat.com are Bending Truth and A Thin Line. Editorial consultant is Lucy Scott of lucymedia.com. Additional production help from Amber Robinson, Janice Sue, and Elise Weber. Executive producers are Sharon Richards and me, Claire Sanimal. Special thanks to Yakima Police Chief Matthew Murray and Gary Hurd for talking to me in this episode. Tune in next week as we continue our search to understand what happened to Damien Hurd and who, if anyone, is responsible.